Hi, dear movie breakers. We're still at Sundance and it's the day before the last day. Prizes have already been given yesterday morning, actually quite early for a festival, because usually they're given on the evening of the day before the final day. But at Sundance, they were already given yesterday, and that is in the morning. So when I say that we were at the prize ceremony, I mean me, Leader, and my guest, Olivia. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, Lita. How are you doing?
Yeah, tired. And you?
Also a bit tired, but hanging in there. I think hanging on to every coffee, more
yes,
or less.
That is a good moral. So tell us a little bit, who are you, so that your listeners know you?
Absolutely. So my name is Olivia. I'm based between Berlin and Brussels. I'm a writer, critic, journalist, and sometimes programmer. I write for the Brussels-based European trade publication Cine Europa, and also I'm a freelancer more generally, and I co-edit a queer film publication called Purple Hour, which is currently still growing, but if you have an interest in queer film and all things queer and queered with this ending, I invite you to check it out.
Amazing. So with a little look on the awards that were awards that were awarded to many of the films. Was there anything that really surprised you? Or was there any film where you said, I thought or wanted this one to win, but it didn't get anything?
It's a good question. I think for some of the special jury awards, it's always quite interesting to see what pops out, because the jury is invited to sort of create their own prize category. And so things like Filipiniana given an award for creative vision, you know, these are kind of interesting categories that sometimes spring out of nowhere, you know, sometimes are very much dependent on the jury themselves and what their interests are. So I wouldn't necessarily call it surprising per se, but I think it's very interesting to see what pops out or stands out to each jury.
Yeah, there was this one feeling that I had that I sometimes also have at European festivals, and that's what I call everybody gets something. So the idea that prizes are not, as the Oscars, for example, awarded in bunches to one film, where there really is this one big winner film. It seems here to be much more important which films are buzzy than which films actually get the awards. For example, the titles from the premiere section hardly got any awards, which I don't criticize, since these are usually the bigger budget titles with major stars. But it's interesting to see that these films, which are talked about a lot, don't necessarily play a role for the awards.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting structure that Sundance kind of unfolds per se, in such that the premiere section is very much, as you said, from my understanding, these buzzier titles that aren't actually a competitive category, if I'm not mistaken, but, you know, it's something that the festival knows will already get, you know, is already sold, maybe is already distributed either, you know, in nationally or worldwide. And then the titles that end up in the competition sections are ones that are kind of poised to break out. And so I had actually spoken with one of the senior programmers, and he was explaining a little bit about how that works and the goal of trying to maybe get filmmakers who are in their debut or sophomore features, especially in these competitive sections, chances to meet with sales agents and so on. And so I think from this year, Leviticus was a really interesting example of how this structure is supposed to play to the filmmaker's interests. You know, whether that actually happens in practice is another question or another story, but this idea that, you know, a smaller, you know, queer horror film could ultimately be one of the biggest early sales of the festival, I think is quite interesting. But, you know, I think North American festivals, especially like Sundance and Toronto, are super different than European film festivals, which is something that I've grown to realize, you know, first starting out in the U.S. film space and then gradually making my way over to the European. And I think people have their preferences and their priorities when it comes to what they like about, you know, each festival. But I would say Sundance is its own, you know, unique beast.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned Leviticus, because I just saw that film yesterday morning and I really like it. It's in a midnight section. And as I mentioned already several times, I always try to get the whole midnight section just because I love horror and because it's very high quality films usually. And Leviticus was really very interesting, a little reminiscent of It Follows, but basically dealing with repression, like social repression of queerness, not in the US, but in Australia. So that also was an interesting factor, because I think many people see Australia and New Zealand as very liberal countries, but even there are very backwards religious communities. So that one landed a big sale, and that was interesting, but I'm happy actually to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still haven't, you know, seen it yet, but it was almost a surprise. Maybe this was a surprise to me. You know, there's also films like Olivia Wilde's The Invite, which is maybe a more expected sale, for instance, at the festival.
Of course, that was the big audience hit. Like, people flocked to that film, so hours long lines,
very, very different, but you know, two polar opposites in a way of things that kind of break out from a festival like this.
Yeah, and one little thing that we maybe should mention regarding the awards before we move on to the films actually that we are presenting you today is that there are no Best Acting Awards, which is all right. I would not say that it's a necessity at a film festival. I think it's good if different festivals have different priorities and different structures.
That's a good observation. I hadn't really thought about that.
I didn't notice this last year. It took me 2 years to realize it.
It's definitely Sundance brands itself as a filmmaker forward festival, and I think a lot of actors turned filmmakers or actors turned directors have also come from this festival. You know, we have people like Brady Corbet, who, you know, was in Mysterious Skin and now is best known as a director, for instance. We also have Olivia Wilde, as mentioned previously, from the U.S. context. This year, the cast of Lady within the World Cinema Dramatic was given a special jury mention for the ensemble, which I guess speaks to this acting prize. But again, that's something that the jury decides on themselves, and it varies year by year. And one thing that I actually want to note about Lady is that I was reading this morning that even though the acting prize was given to the ensemble, I don't think any of the ensemble was able to make it to the U.S. because of visa issues, which is, I think, quite disheartening, but I think important context for an award
like
this.
Absolutely.
So that was something that I was reading about this morning, and I think is just important to mention.
Yeah, that is a very good point. So let's talk a little bit about what have you seen in terms of films that you like to mention today that stood out to you?
Absolutely. So I think one of the films that I watched early on that really hit me was the World Cinema Dramatic Competition winner, which is Shame and Money by Lisa Morina. Morina is a Germany-based filmmaker and director from Kosovo. It's actually his second film in this competition. The first one was Exile from, I believe, 2020. In a way, it's not necessarily a very Sundance-y film. I think a lot of people talk about, oh, this is a Sundance film, this is a Sundance film. But the film, the way it unfolds, is slow, but not in a way that, it doesn't have a plotting pace. And essentially, it's about a couple that is forced from the countryside of Kosovo into Pristina, the capital of the city, after there's essentially a incident with the family that causes their cows to go missing. And once they're forced into the capital, they essentially have to undertake, different types of labor and gig work that completely puts them out of their comfort zone and completely puts them out of their element, because they discover that they have to survive off of this ultra-capitalistic environment. The performances are absolutely just spectacular. There's one super intense sequence near the end that sees the husband in the story completely at his wit's end, completely being exploited. And I think he just really captures the essence of what it means for people to have dignity. I did an interview with the director during the festival, and he spoke about the price of dignity. And I think the title Shame and Money ultimately, puts these two themes together in a way that I think really speaks to something powerful.
This is a very interesting point. And I think it's also interesting in this context that now classism and class hierarchies get more attention in films, and also to see how fragile people's existences are in the lower working class and underclass, that one event can happen and it just shatters your existence, that you do not have these safety nets that middle class people and upper working class people often have.
Very much. It's, this kind of the stark difference in class is put into perspective in the film. And I think the director really uses some very interesting symbolism to depict this. Kosovo's context, there's a lot of symbolism, not only symbolism, but motifs depicting the U.S. because the Kosovo generations of the old generations feeling indebted to the U.S. in the 90s, but then this new younger generation coming out of that and dispelling this idea of the American dream and sort of rejecting that. Yeah, the way he plays with music as well in the film is very interesting, looking at combining more traditional music with also more pop songs. It deals with this idea of the duality of tradition and modernity in a way that is not cliche at all, and puts into perspective the environment in Kosovo in a way that audiences probably haven't seen before on screen. So I'm really happy to see this film getting more attention, both critically and audience-wise. The film is a little over 2 hours, which I know can be a little bit, you know, off-putting maybe to some audiences, but I think it's really, the film grows in intensity so fast and it really sucks you in.
Yeah, that sounds like a very interesting recommendation.
Definitely.
I'll say a little bit about the U.S. dramatic competition winner, and that is Josephine. It's about a little girl that witnesses a disturbing, violent incident and then has to deal with this as she has to stand as a witness in court to testify against the defendant in this Kurt case that arises from this issue. And back then when Patrick discussed the film, we had not talked about what actually happens. And I think now after the director's statement during the award ceremony and all that has been written about this film, I think it's fair to say that what happens also, since it happens right in the beginning of the film, so it's not a big spoiler, the little girl witnesses a rape happening in the park. So it's an incident of extreme sexualized violence that she doesn't really understand in its full implications and what happens. She understands that something violent happens, that something terrible is done to the woman that she sees, but she doesn't understand this whole sexual context of it. And I think it's very interesting because this film only really focuses on the little girl, wonderfully portrayed by Mason Reeves. Her parents are played by Channing Tatum and Gemma Chan. But this focus on a kid slowly realizing that, so that there's a form of violence that is specifically directed to you and can be directed to you by the other sex. So I think this kind of deeper understanding of the structures in society, patriarchy and sexism and misogyny, and also facing this when she gets cross-examined. The lawyer of the defendant then tells her something like, sometimes pleasure looks like pain, and sometimes pain and pleasure are interchangeable. Really, really gripping, interesting drama. Even though it falls into a category that I see somewhat critically, this is a film that actually has big stars and a major budget, but occupies the visual identity of an independent film. And technically, it is an independent film, but these technicalities are sometimes a minor factor. So I always see that critically. But still, the director, Beth Araujo, comes from an independent background.
I haven't seen the film yet, but I know it's gotten so much buzz. And as you said, after the statement by the director, and you know, the audience award often goes to a more lighthearted film. But I think the fact that it also won the audience award speaks to how powerful the film is. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing it tonight. Or looking forward is maybe a wrong turn of phrase, but I think it's a necessary watch that I will be doing, and I think it'll be really interesting to see how film unfolds as well.
Just to go back to one little thing that the director said about rapists, that it's not the time to empathize and understand them. And I think that's a very important statement in many terms, because we live in a society that often tends to empathize more with the perpetrator than with the victim in many contexts. Even in politics, it's often like if there's a right-wing surge, it's often like, oh, we should understand those people. No, this kind of empathy where I say, like, this is misguided empathy.
Not a courtroom drama, is it?
No, it's not a courtroom drama. Okay. I would say it has different chapters. So maybe one could divide it in three chapters. Okay. That the first features just a little girl and her world. The second is more like on her family dynamics. And the third is then a little courtroom drama. But it's just one small part. Okay. So it's not the classical part from Do you have something more from the documentary section?
Definitely. Yeah, I saw a few from that Birds of War. I saw Everybody to Kemmerer Street. And this morning, I actually just saw the winner of the World Cinema Documentary, which was Nuisance Bear. This is a really interesting film because, first I want to mention that's by Gabriela Osio-Vanden and Jack Weissman. And it's interesting because it's kind of branded itself as the anti-nature documentary, but when I saw it, I was really stunned by how it combines really, really potent animal footage, also a lot of drone footage, with, you know, a story of indigenous resistance in terms of the Canadian context. So that the film is mainly set in Churchill, Manitoba, Canada. And so quite, you know, far north, where a lot of polar bears live. It's known as the polar bear capital of the world, according to the film. And, you know, it jumps through a number of different narratives, but in a way that's is really coherent, because it begins by explaining how a lot of tourists come to Churchill to see the polar bears. And it's a very extractive process. You know, the tourists come there, the tour operators have these huge trucks that they drive onto the rocks and onto the land and onto the ice sometimes, depending on the season. And they go see the polar bears. And then we interject by hearing some Inuit narratives and Inuit voiceover that explains how, you know, polar bear migration and polar bear presence has changed over the years. And the presence of polar bears it's a very fragile balance, because the Inuits, they wouldn't necessarily see polar bears decades ago. And now they're coming into the towns and they're coming to look for trash, coming onto the land when they're not really supposed to be on land, essentially. When there's sea ice, the polar bears are meant to be on the sea ice hunting. And instead, they're hungry and they're on land and they're thus getting into trash, you know, dumpsters and homes and so on. The film really, during the last third, it's a really intense unfolding, because we get into an element of the film where we're following the polar bears as well as the Canadian park rangers, or rangers rather, who are chasing the polar bears, chasing as in quote unquote chasing, but trying to move them into areas that are outside of this town. And at the most extreme, they will tranquilize the polar bears, move them into actual facilities, and then airlift them elsewhere. So basically physically transplant them elsewhere, which is just, there's a scene in the film where we see the polar bear motionless in this big net suspended from a helicopter.
Such a bizarre sight, you know, like a polar bear in the air.
100%. It's so weird and it's out of body, but the drone is following the polar bear and from above, and it just feels so, it's such an out of body element, because we see the power of humans also over the animals. And the film, I think the camera ultimately very much empathizes with the polar bear. And then even as we see, and in the sort of last third, where we move into this Inuit community, they, you know, we suddenly see how their relationship with the polar bears is much more empathetic, and ultimately a bit of an antithesis to how the Canadian government or the Manitoba government has been dealing with polar bears' presence.
This most interesting aspect from this film for me, I haven't seen it yet, but maybe I will take the time, because it's such a striking story, is that there has been a case that was somewhat similar, is maybe far taken, but there were parallels with a case in Germany that's a bunch of years ago, actually. And there was an individual, a brown bear, because Central Europe was the so-called problem bear. One bear that wandered into Germany, first bear after more than 100 years, bears being extinct in Germany, hunted to extinction. And now this problem bear came back, kicked over a couple of trash cans. And then there were a lot of discussions, what do we do with this bear? And there were animal rights organizations, there were people and like farmers who were like worried about their livestock, people who questioned, could this bear maybe kill somebody? Well, brown bears are not very aggressive, far less aggressive than polar bears or grizzlies, so they're not very dangerous. But all these fears and different interests were bubbling up, and ultimately the poor bear, which then was dubbed Bruno, was killed, as many of you remember. But that was this interesting, also the title parallel, that nuisance bear, problem bear, and these parallels of animals, wild animals that have been extinct or driven from their natural habitat, returning or progressing in human domain, or supposedly human domain in quotes, you know, and then that we don't know anymore how to deal with these animals.
Definitely. There's a part in Nuisance Bear where our sort of Inuit narrative voiceover, or it's a man named Mike Gibbons, and he explains how, you know, the bears are, he describes it as saying the bears are from the past, but they're living in the present. And so they're animals that are from the past, but having to live with this human present that essentially, you know, humans have encroached on their past. Humans have encroached on their land. And the film also explains a bit about this nuisance bear term. And there's an Inuit term that refers more to this idea that the bears are likely adolescent bears who have been taken from their mothers when they're too young and essentially have been forced to fend on their own and grow up on their own, while the English term is much more blunt and simply says nuisance bear without any sort of nuance. And I think that also speaks to the two approaches and how to so-called deal with or handle these animals. You know, this idea that, okay, it's about protection of the human populations, but also the ways in which they're scaring the bears away with loud noises and flashbangs and non-lethal ways are actually ultimately harming the bears in the long run as well.
Yeah, so I guess another recommendation from the documentary category, which is always very, very strong. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe a good context for my second film, which technically is not a documentary, but it's very much based in real life experience, especially regarding its main actress. And this film is Take Me Home. It will in a little about 2 weeks also be at Berlinale. And Take Me Home is the feature film debut from director Liz Sargent, and she made a short film of the same title. And both films, her short film and this feature, had as a main actress her sister Anne Sargent, and Anne Sargent has a cognitive disability. Still, she's basically acting as herself. The basic family structures in this family that the film focuses on are strongly inspired by the real life family of Liz and Anne Sargent, even though we should maybe mention that there are differences. For example, the Sargent sisters, they have, I think, like 9 more siblings. Wow. And in the family that we see in the film, it's only 2 mm-hmm, sisters. Sure. I think that's just simply for dramatic reasons, that it's easier just to focus on these characters and not have like 9 supporting characters somewhere. There are the aging parents of the sister Emily. The Emily would basically be a fictional alter ego of Liz and Anne. Emily has moved out since a while also to protect herself from all the pressure that's going on in this family, because at the moment her elderly parents are taking care of Anne, who is, she can dress herself, she can feed herself, but she's not capable to organize daily logistics on her own. So for example, she wouldn't wash for days, or she wouldn't remember to just eat different things than just junk food, or to respect laws like not shoplifting or things. So somebody has to have an eye on her, even though she's pretty self-sufficient. And at the same time, the parents are both declining physically. The mother gets weaker and weaker. The father has dementia. So 2 different kinds of physical and neurological decline. And Anne, at the same time, while she's been taken care of, also becomes a caretaker of her parents. And this co-dynamic that's both tender but also toxic is very interesting and very well observed.
It's, yeah, the sort of auto-fiction element of the film is really interesting to me. I also haven't seen the film, but it's one that I really have my eye on. I think especially because how, you know, first, how personal the story is, and secondly, also the idea that, for instance, the film, the creation of the film can also be an act of care amongst the family between Liz and Anne, and an act of growing closer as well.
Yeah, and there's also this whole aspect of the social system in the US, because the film is set in the USA. It runs in the US dramatic competition, where it also won a prize.
I think it was this screenwriting prize.
This whole social system, because when the parents then start looking for a place, maybe at a facility where Anne could go, then one of the social workers tells them, well, we have a waiting list and it's like 15,000 people.
Oh my gosh.
So wow. It's insane. Like the system is completely overwhelmed, and there isn't any realistic chance that a person without big money or anything like that would get a place at one of these facilities. Uh-huh. And the only other alternative that the parents then would have, if they simply aren't physically and mentally capable anymore of having Anne live with them, would just to abandon her at a hospital, like bring her to some hospital, just leave, cut off any contact, because if any contact with the family is established, social services will do nothing. So they really would be forced to never see her again, never speak to her again. And this is really, this is like just state cruelty, and it's incredible. And this for me was one of the most striking and urgent issues of the film.
Yeah. The way it's, wow, that's really I mean, it speaks to the sort of between a rock and a hard place that I think the lack of welfare system in the U.S., you know, it's ultimately true to life, even if there are fictional elements, and something that I really respect about a lot of, you know, independent U.S. filmmakers who do take on stories like this, you know, because they do engage in a sort of social critique of the system. And I think that is a way also to get audiences at Sundance, you know, thinking about these issues. You know, I was thinking about just to briefly go back to the nuisance bear points, you know, I was looking at the cinema, and ultimately a lot of especially at the end of the festival, a lot of the audience members are simply older, you know, wealthier, middle-aged white audience, you know, goers and festival goers. And they all really respect the films. And I do think they take a lot of care in trying to understand every film that they watch. But ultimately, I think a lot of these audiences that come to Sundance are very privileged and may not necessarily see certain perspectives. But I think that's also a really strong value of having stories like this at a festival like this. And of course, there's a lot of, you know, political things that happen when it comes to selecting, you know, films for a festival, you know, such as Sundance. But I think it is nice that, you know, an audience member might be able to see something like this, especially that engages with elements of class and ability, and can maybe take it in and hopefully learn something, or hopefully take something away and do something with it as well in their own lives.
Yeah, this aspect about the Sundance audience is an interesting point, because you really notice that we here have an elderly audience, or a strong segment of the elderly audience, and that it's one with old money. And this, yeah, the ticket prices are insane.
Crazy,
ticket packages,
yeah.
They cost like thousands of dollars. So if you think like Berlinale or Cannes is expensive, wait until you get to Sundance. And even though the festival always advertises and says, yeah, we have programs where students or people with less money can access tickets for a reduced price, or there is a certain amount of free tickets, those are really small amounts. So it's often like just a little drop on the fire, but it's more like, I would almost say, like, it's more like image purposes than actually really having an impact on ticket sales and ticket, how tickets are dispensed. Take Me Home, it's basically an observational film, so I would recommend it, even though it's not a perfect film at all. The story really doesn't so much progress. It's more the observation of one specific situation. And as such, it's interesting, but it's not really a strong narrative development or character development with conflict. And but I think it's worthy checking it out, maybe at Berlinale if you don't get it at Sundance.
Remind me which section it's playing in. Is it?
I think it's Panorama.
As in Panorama. Okay. Okay. That'll be really interesting.
I'm not 100% sure, because it's either Panorama or Special, but I believe it was Panorama.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That seems like it would fit.
It would fit, yeah.
Very much. I think I maybe want to mention one more. But I do really, you know, all the films that I mentioned, I have really enjoyed, and I would really recommend. And this one is one that I think it's different in many ways, but it's also very similar in many ways. It won the directing award in the World Cinema Competition, and it's How to Divorce During the War by Lithuanian filmmaker Andrius Blazevicius. I'm personally a big fan of Lithuanian film, or at least Lithuanian film in the last few years, so that's also why I want to give it a shout out. Film's title foreshadows what plays out during the film, which is a woman, a 30-something-year-old media executive, decides to divorce her husband of 12 years, and they have a 12-year-old daughter, and it's one day before Russia invades Ukraine in February 2022. So it pits this very personal drama against this political drama, if you will, personal conflict, political conflict, situated in Lithuania, which is, again, in close proximity to Ukraine. So the stakes are ultimately very heightened. And it plays out as a bit of a dark comedy, which is really unexpected, or it was unexpected for me. But essentially, it looks at Maria, who is this, you know, high-flying executive who works with this nondescript media company that creates sort of blah content for the attention age online, these media little reels that, you know, get millions of views but ultimately are completely meaningless. And then we have Vitas, her husband or ex-husband, who's a sort of bygone indie filmmaker who made one film in 2014 and, you know, no longer is relevant. So we have these two that are really looking for different ideals in their lives. As the film plays out, there's more and more performativity. So I think the writer-director really interrogates this idea of performativity in an age of, you know, digital media. For instance, Vitas goes to a protest against the war, but he's sort of drawn into this idea that he has to literally perform. He has to literally be part of this theater demonstration, while Maria, on the other hand, takes in a Ukrainian family in order to try to look like she's compassionate and empathetic. And it really, you know, I think they're both relatable characters, both Maria and Vitas, but it's very interesting how the director prods and pries at this idea of who are we performing for? Are we really ultimately are we actually empathetic towards the causes that we're defending? Or is it just to seem like we're good Samaritans and seem like we're good people? One thing that I want to point out, I think that really speaks to the award that it won in directing, is that Blazevicius basically takes a still frame for much of the film. He distances the viewer from his characters so immensely that it's almost like it feels like the viewer has to kind of lean into the screen to feel close to our characters. And he does this, I believe, you know, really intentionally, because it's not necessarily about having this melodramatic high or potent low, but having this way that to see how would the viewer act in this situation, and how would the viewer think about these characters without getting too close. Because I think a lot of films like this run the risk of making the viewer feel too close to the characters, and then we kind of empathize with them almost too much. And I think he's asking us as the viewer to say, you know, well, let's actually criticize the characters on screen. We might be able to relate to them, but let's critique how they're behaving as well.
Do you think that this film has a chance to get a major release?
It's really interesting, because actually I want to point out the sort of track record that Lithuanian film has had at Sundance, which is last big film, which was Slow at Sundance in 2023, won the exact same award. It won the directing award.
That is an interesting question.
Yeah, so it's, I think, very interesting how Lithuanian filmmakers have maybe sort of accidentally carved out their niche for bringing a very unique directing style to their, you know, to the oeuvre of films, if you will. You know, it's really hard to say. I think it'll be interesting to see where the film travels next. I think the topic is definitely something that will bring a lot of attention at, you know, other festivals, especially surrounding, you know, the war in Ukraine. It will, in many cases, distance some audiences. Like, I think not every audience will resonate with how it's shot, because it's, again, we see when people are crying on screen, they're far away. Like, we can't get close to the characters. It's a little bit unsettling in that way. Not necessarily a natural crowd pleaser, if you will, but I think it's a really thought-provoking film. So I think it'll be interesting to see where it goes next. And, you know, I can imagine it absolutely going to Carlo Vivari, for instance. There's often been a very strong Lithuanian presence there. But I think it's, you know, important to also praise the filmmaker for, you know, what he does differently. And yeah, it'll be really interesting to see where the film gains its audience as well.
Thank you. So I will just quickly mention one more film from the premiere section. And this is also a documentary that is called Give Me the Ball. And it's about the Billie Jean King documentary.
Nice.
About her career. So this is really your classic, glossy, high-stakes documentary. It's very entertaining. Also, thanks to Billie Jean King, the main focus of the documentary, and also speaks in it about her life. She was one of the top tennis players in the world, both male and female. I especially say both male and female because there's this one incident in her life where she played Bobby Riggs. There was also an eponymous film about it, Battle of the Sexes. Well, we know that she won that match, even though there was some criticism at the time that she was playing. She was like, I think, 15 years or something younger than Bobby Riggs, who was, I think, around 50 or something. So there is a certain element of youth, of course, but it just proved that women can compete against men. And so this was an important point. And also that she was gay at a time when it was not really accepted, that she was publicly outed, and that almost, I wouldn't say it tanked her career, but it really affected her. So that was a very interesting documentary, and it also chronicled her fight for equal pay in sports.
Very much.
And actually, in tennis, women were awarded finally equal pay thanks to the campaigning of Billie Jean King and her colleagues.
It's interesting to see this sort of, maybe not resurgence, but tennis documentaries. Now, and also we saw Nasty last year at Cannes. And I'm curious actually about Give Me the Ball, because I haven't seen it. You're mentioning all these films that I really want to see, but I haven't yet. But how does it play out? You know, is it more talking heads heavy? Is it archival footage? What does it look
like? It's a mix. Yeah. Like, it's a mix of this talking heads. And this, of course, we have Billie Jean King, and we have one of her best friends, Elton John. We have her longtime partner, Ileana Kass.
Nice.
Really, her ex-husband. So they had an amicable divorce. She was married for a long time to Larry King, not related to the other Larry King, but yeah, her husband. And then she finally finally, when she had her coming out day divorce, we see all these figures. We see other high-class tennis players like the Williams sisters. There was an incident when she was that she trained the Williams sisters at a local tennis camp. So we see all those figures, and this is really like one of those high-class, high-budget documentaries. It's still, again, technically an independent film, but really there's nothing about this film that looks independent. It's very entertaining, very interesting, and a well-deserved tribute to Billie Jean King.
Yeah, I really wanted to get around to that also for the sort of queer dimension of the film, you know, speaking to Billie Jean King herself, but also how that feeds in. There's been a number of different films recently that look at icons as well as incorporating, looking at also how their partners play a role, or life partners, the agency that they also provide and play. You know, for instance, we have, at least at Sundance now, there was a Barbara Hammer documentary, and because, you know, she passed in 2019, we also have the role of Barbara's longtime, her life partner, Flory Burke. Her partner is ultimately the person who guides the narrative. And we also have the Sally Ride documentary from, I believe, last year. And we have Tam O'Shaughnessy, who's again guiding the narrative. So I think it's very interesting to see how we have these sapphic icons.
The first American female astronaut in space, Sally Ride, not the first female astronaut. Russia was first always in space.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, yeah, Sally Ride almost feels like a counterpart to Billie Jean King documentary, because
Much. That's interesting to hear. Yeah. So I am curious about how the, you know, Billie Jean's partner plays a role in the film. But I like that, you know, especially because same-sex partners are often erased from narratives of their more famous partners. I think it's very interesting to see how they ultimately play a role and how they're depicted on screen as well.
That was our final episode from Sundance. So if you would have to wrap this festival up in one word, or a couple of sentences also, one word is always very tough. What would you say?
I'm sure, as you've probably mentioned, this is the last Park City Sundance. And to say it's an end of an era is maybe a strong word, but I think it's, at least for me, if I can speak from a personal perspective, I came to Sundance multiple times around 7 or 8 years ago. And coming back is an interesting way to reflect on it. I think for me, it's looking at what Sundance brings, but also what Sundance lacks compared to other types of festivals. And putting it in perspective, for instance, a lot of European festivals, which feel much more accessible, I think is something that I've really been reflecting on, especially the privilege that I have being here this year, coming from the European setting. So it was more than a couple set words, but just thinking about accessibility, I think maybe that's the word, accessibility.
I think that's a very good word, because for me, it would be probably sobering, since last year was my very first Sundance and I was so excited just to be here. Accessibility is a good point, because this year I could much more see how big the role is that money and hierarchies, contacts actually play at this festival, and also how hard it is to be accepted. Even though this is my second Sundance year, I still couldn't get any talent interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just speaks about the festival, that you really have to be 3 or 4 or 5 years maybe into the festival and need to have contacts, you need to have relations, you maybe need a really, really big outlet behind you to even have a chance to get interviews and real access. That really says a lot about the whole mechanisms of the festival work. So yeah,
definitely would 100%.
Thanks so much for having been here, Olivia, and I hope to see you next year in Boulder.
Very much. Thank you so much for the invite. We'll see about Boulder.
That was Sundance 2026, end of an era, and we hear each other at Berlinale.